Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome back our speaker for today, Professor Simon Platt, based at College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Georgia. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Firstly, just want to check that you can hear. We've got good volume. Okay, great. Well, welcome to the next in the series of webinars. For the Neurology Club, we're going to deal with seizure activity on an emergency basis. It's very easy for us to develop protocols for frequent emergencies such as cardiac arrest, and we often know where the drugs are, what doses to draw up, who's giving them, who's manipulating the chest, if we're going to do that, who's supplying the oxygen. But for status epilepticus, we rarely have such protocols in place. And so today we're going to try and present a cookbook approach to emergency seizure treatment and try to establish a 1-2-3 of what to do. Before we get there, it's important for us to talk about what emergency seizures are. There's two areas of emergency seizures that we often deal with. They could be both combined together and called acute repetitive seizures. But the two types that comprise these are cluster seizures, and cluster seizures are more than two or three seizures in 24 hours, versus status epilepticus, where we don't get a break between the seizures. They may seizure for 90 seconds, look like they're stopping and then start again, or just have absolutely no break whatsoever. And once the seizure activity has gone on for 5 minutes, then we're well within the definition of status epilepticus. Now, when we look at the facts behind status epilepticus in veterinary medicine, we know that it's not an uncommon emergency. Any time a dog seizures, you have a 6 out of 10 chance that that dog will end up having status epilepticus at one point in its life, whatever the underlying cause. In dogs that have idiopathic epilepsy, so potentially the best form of seizure activity, 5% of dogs will have status epilepticus, and up to 20% of cats that have idiopathic epilepsy will also exhibit this type of emergency. There are breed predispositions. Those dogs that exhibit the most aggressive types of seizures are Australian Shepherds and Border Collies. And so any time one of these breeds particularly exhibits generalized seizure activity of a self-limiting type, we need to make sure that we're ready and the owners are ready in the future for a status epilepticus. When we look at the overall causes, it's kind of spread across the board. So approximately a third will have idiopathic epilepsy. A third will have structural epilepsy, where we're talking about inflammation, tumors, hydrocephalus, stroke. And then a third, roughly, will have an unknown cause. And so that could be any one of the above, but the patients have never, in the studies that took place, didn't undergo any type of investigation. Up to 1 out of 10 patients that have status epilepticus will have reactive epilepsy, and this is due to metabolic diseases such as hepatic encephalopathy and hypoglycemia, as well as intoxications. And these type of seizure activities will rarely stop until the underlying metabolic or toxic cause is identified and treated. Finally, a few seizures that result in status epilepticus will be related to changes or a drop of anti-epileptic medication, so some type of failure of medication in these patients. Important to say, though, before we also talk about the physiological effects of status epilepticus, that it is a serious, fatal emergency in veterinary medicine. In people that exhibit status epilepticus with idiopathic epilepsy, up to 20% of those people will end up dying during that event. And so when we talk about veterinary medicine cases, we're talking about causes that are across the board, as we've said, and therefore likely that the fatality rate is going to be a lot higher. We need to make sure we acknowledge this and warn the owners that this is a severe emergency, because whatever we do try to treat these patients with may fail. The knock-on effects of status epilepticus are pretty severe, and hence the reason for some of that mortality. There are some severe systemic effects, and we'll start with compromised respiration. If you have an emergency seizure activity, where you have involuntary activity of all of the limbs, then it's likely that we're going to have involuntary activity of the chest cavity. So we've got a mechanical impairment. We're not breathing in, breathing out in a regular routine fashion. In addition, when we have electrical abnormalities in the brain, it's not too hard to believe that those abnormalities will impair the respiratory center, so that we don't have a good detection of oxygen, carbon dioxide concentrations, resulting in a rate which is appropriate and a depth which is appropriate. And in some degree, this is also described by the autonomic dysfunction that these patients will experience. So significant respiration issues can take place if your seizure activity goes on for a protracted period of time. Of course, during the usual 1 to 2 minute seizures that we see, self-limiting seizures that we see, then it's unlikely that this will actually have a clinical effect. In the status epilepticus cases, it's likely that this will ultimately lead to hypoxia. In addition to respiratory compromise, we have cardiac compromise. Similar types of causes. We have autonomic dysfunction because we don't have normal electrical discharges now in the brain. And so rate and contractility of the heart are going to be affected by sympathetic, parasympathetic abnormalities. In addition to the hypoxia from the respiratory side effects or systemic effects of status epilepticus, we're likely to experience ischemic damage in the cardiac wall or in the myocardium. End result of all of this is an arrhythmia. Now again, not something that we're likely to see in our self-limiting seizure. However, it is something which we need to start worrying about in cases which have experienced protracted seizure activity. So in these cases, if we're able to stop the seizure activity, we should be on the lookout for arrhythmias and then subsequent drops in blood pressure. Finally, there's renal compromise. We have hypotension, most likely resulting from cardiac dysfunction, in addition to the medications that we are actually giving. So as we'll talk about, the benzodiazepines, barbiturates, will reduce blood pressure. And this, in addition to the poor perfusion, which is going to be existing in the place of cardiac dysfunction, is going to leave the muscles open to damage. And these muscles will be further damaged if the patient experiences hypothermia. Anytime the patient's body temperature exceeds 104 or 40 degrees C, then we may see hypothermic damage to the muscle, which leads to the potential of myoglobinuria and even renal insufficiency as a result. So we have poor respiration leading to hypoxia, and autonomic dysfunction can lead to cardiac and dysfunction, leading to hypotension, and hypotension in addition to hyperthermia can lead to acute renal dysfunction. So we need to be on the lookout for the effects of status epilepticus to the rest of the body. However, initially we've got to be primed, obviously, to stop the seizure activity. Prolonged seizure activity will result in hypoxia in the nervous system and hypoglycemia, and these are the two things which will cause central nervous system damage. This damage becomes irreversible after 90 minutes. Now, in a person, this may be noted as a reduction in memory or an alteration of behavioral skills. It may not be detected so easily in our veterinary patients. However, the more damage that ensues, the more likely that our patients will have a tough to control seizure focus. So there is a statement that suggests that the more seizure activity we have, the more that we're going to have. And so stopping seizure activity prior to getting to at least this 90 minute threshold is extremely important, so that we don't have brain damage at least leading to more severe seizure activity. The results of protracted seizure activity can be seen with effects on the cerebellum, hippocampus and the cerebrum. So this will often leave our dogs and cats experiencing incoordination shortly after this activity, behavioural changes and also blindness, because it's the occipital lobe of the cerebrum which is most sensitive to reductions of both oxygen and glucose. So this may not be a surprise for us to see neurologic dysfunction so soon after a protracted seizure activity. Whether this is something that is temporary or permanent is always difficult to predict, unfortunately. So when we think about status epilepticus, I'm going to share with you a video that was shared with me by Dr. Boyd Jones at the University of Dublin of a cat with generalized seizure activity. I apologize for the Charlie Chaplin nature of this video, but it's not often that we'll actually get video of generalized seizure activity in a cat. And so here we can see it's starting to be focal, then become generalized. And I'm showing this to emphasize the difficulty that we face in trying to stop seizure activity. In a textbook, it would say that we need IV catheter and then administer the drugs. Well, if this is the patient that we are dealing with, IV catheter access is going to be extremely difficult. So we need to remember this patient as we go through our treatment paradigm and discuss alternatives or ways around this very practical issue. So what we must start with when we see a patient with status epilepticus is the idea of it being a team approach. This may not be possible at 2 o'clock in the morning in your own practice, and so we need again to find workarounds. If you do have a team approach, then we need someone to be dealing with the admission of this patient, at least in terms of taking a history from the owners. If it is just you on your own dealing with this patient, then it's wise to develop a check sheet of questions that the owner needs to shout out the answer as yes to important questions, which will include: has your dog or cat had seizure activity before? Are they on medication? What is it? Have they had recent serum levels for this medication? Are they on medication for any other disease? Have they experienced a trauma recently? Any chance of intoxications, any generalized illnesses in the last 2 or 3 weeks. So questions that you would naturally ask if the patient presented with a self-limiting seizure, but these are of a more urgent basis. It's extremely important for us to know whether they have exhibited prior seizure activity, are on medication, etc., because it may determine what medications we use and how successful we think that they're going to be. Once we have someone dealing with that, then obviously we direct our attention to the patient, and primarily this is in the form of giving medication, but there are some things that we also need to keep in mind. Some of these are not possible initially, some of them are things which we can only do at the end of seizure activity. However, if it is possible, we need someone trying to achieve this immediately. Rectal temperature is going to be important to monitor, because the minute it goes above 104 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 degrees C, we might start to have muscle damage, as we mentioned. So trying to cool the patient passively will help. Obviously, this is much easier once we've actually got the patient under control. Blood work is going to be difficult to actually obtain at the time of seizure activity. So it's going to be something which we have to get shortly afterwards, and some of it can be affected by the seizure activity itself. So a hematology or CBC may be altered, as may our serum chemistry when we're looking for things like liver enzymes, for instance. However, there's some things we need to try to get an established level of to see whether it's important or involved in the seizure activity itself. So in our serum chemistry, we're very interested in electrolyte levels, calcium levels, glucose levels, potentially liver function, toxicity screens if we believe there's been exposure to a certain toxin. So there are things that we could benefit from, but it is accepted that it's difficult to get blood from a patient like that cat who's seizuring. If we believe that hypoglycemia is a possible cause of the seizure activity, then we should just go ahead and treat. And again, if you've not got IV access, it's a difficult thing to achieve. So we can't really go ahead and give a dextrose solution injection intravenously. Most of the time we're going to give an oral solution, so to some type of honey or syrup that we can give under the tongue, which will, in cases of hypoglycemia, such as puppies with high parasite burden, toy breed dogs, hunting dogs, those dogs that are likely to get hypoglycemia may benefit from this. It would be difficult to treat these dogs with just anticonvulsants. In addition to taking the temperature, thinking about getting blood tests, treating with Kera syrup or some type of honey solution, then we should also have oxygen on standby. And if you do have a team approach, it may well be worth getting someone to turn on the oxygen and administer by flow by. That's just a tube in the vicinity of the dog's mouth or nose to increase oxygenation, and this can help dramatically with brain function. Ultimately, our aim is to get an intravenous catheter in place. However, again, this is going to be very difficult until the seizure activity is stopped. But materials need to be ready to start getting the catheter in as soon as seizure activity is stopped, because it may start up again. The first step in treating seizure activity is going to be for us to administer a benzodiazepine, so the most effective of our anticonvulsants. Most rapid of the anticonvulsants, but the most short acting. Most of the time, we will think of giving something like diazepam to our patients with seizure activity that's on an emergency basis, because it is tried and tested and very effective. However, this is only usually something we would do if we have IV access. If not, we have to think of another way to administer it, and rectally or nasal administration may be possible. The problem with those two routes of administration is that it may take 10 minutes for them to work, and you may not get all of the dose. So we think of using 1 to 2 mg per kg most of the time. So have a dose in mind in your practice for the smallest of dogs, medium-sized dogs, large dogs, where we can just bolus it without having to work out a precise dose. It's unlikely that you're going to get into any trouble if you slightly overdose dogs with this medication during status epilepticus. If you don't have IV access, then the use of another benzodiazepine like midazolam may be beneficial, because this is a drug that you can give intramuscularly. You can't, unfortunately, give diazepam intramuscularly, so it isn't something that we can rely on if we don't have catheter access. So giving intramuscular midazolam may be a useful alternative to have. You could also give it intravenously if you have IV access and intranasally, but this is not a drug, unfortunately, that has much effect if you give it rectally. This is step one. If the patient responds to step one, then we can secure catheter access and we can start to consider underlying causes, potentially get on top of those, can speak to the owner, the situation could be calmer, and we need to be prepared for the seizure activity to start again. If the seizure activity hasn't stopped in the first place, then we may be able just to repeat another dose of the benzodiazepines. Whether the seizure activity has stopped and started again, so that you need to re-administer another dose, or whether it never stopped in the first place, again, meaning you're administering another dose, then we need to immediately start thinking about step two, and step two is the use of a longer-acting anticonvulsant, which we're going to talk about in a second. But let's just talk briefly about the advantages of midazolam, because I know this is not something that is uniformly used across practices. This is the only water-soluble benzodiazepine, so can easily be used in solutions. As we said, can be delivered intramuscularly, can be delivered by constant rate infusion, can also be delivered intranasally and in the mouth, buccally. It has a fairly erratic availability, unfortunately, so it's not given as frequently as diazepam. Has a quite a wide dose range, but we'll often give it at the top of the dose, so around 0.2 mg per kg. Again, worth having this noted for the smallest, medium-sized and largest dog, so an eyeball type of dose, so that we're not working out 0.2 mg per kg of the body weight and then working out 50 mg per 10 mils. How does that translate into dose? So having that already prepped in your practice for the a range of dogs and cats that you have is going to save some time. Step two, as we mentioned, is a longer acting anticonvulsant. And for these longer acting anticonvulsants, then we're primarily initially considering something like phenobarbital or phenobarbital. This is obviously the drug that we use frequently for long-term seizure activity, but as an injectable drug, it has great value in trying to stop aggressive seizure activity. And because of its long-acting nature, it can be more beneficial sometimes than our benzodiazepines. So we can use phenobarbitone up to 4 mg per kg as a bolus intravenous, or if we haven't got access, intramuscularly. It takes 20 to 30 minutes to actually work, so it isn't something that can rely on immediately, so we still have to rely on the use of benzodiazepines. However, repeat doses of benzodiazepines without using a long-acting anticonvulsant is usually just going to lead to a severely sedated patient if we can stop the seizures with a depressed heart rate and blood pressure. So the use of this drug, once we've given benzodiazepines 2 or 3 times, is really advised. You can repeat the dose every 30 minutes if you've not got initial success bolus dose, and you can repeat it up to a maximum of 24 mg per kg over 24 hours. Just like repeated doses of benzodiazepines, then it's likely that this will lead to a depressed respiratory rate and cardiovascular function. So we're causing more hypotension here, bradyarrhythmias. So this is the sort of thing which means we're creating a bit of a critical care situation. So once, if we're able to stop the seizures, they are stopped, then you can look at blood pressure if you can get a measure of it, and maybe treat this patient with fluids so that we're looking at trying to make them normotensive. If you are looking at trying to get this patient up to a steady state of phenobarbital because they've never been on phenobarbital before, then we will often look at using that same dosing regime of up to 24 mg per kg over 24 hours, and then start them on oral dose. So if we're able with phenobarb to stop the seizure activity, then we can then start them on oral phenobarbital as soon as that steady state is reached, which means that we don't have to wait the 10 to 14 days that we would usually have to wait with oral phenobarb. So if you have a patient where the benzodiazepines have worked but they're just short lasting, or you have a patient where you know there's been an intoxication and the toxin needs to be metabolized prior to the patient stopping seizuring, then we often need something like a constant rate infusion of benzodiazepines. So this is our step 3A. This can be expensive, but is an option for us. In addition to the expense, there are problems logistically with setting this constant rate infusion up. So we can go with diazepam or midazolam, a constant rate infusion for potentially 4 hours at a time. And then we try to wean them down at the end of 4 hours and treat them for another 4 hours at this wean down dose. Try to, if possible, get them off within 24 hours, depending on the underlying cause of the seizure activity. The longer they're on, the more depressed their respiratory system is. Logistically, the problem with using benzodiazepines in constant rate infusions is that they adhere to PVC in the administration sets and they're light sensitive, which means we need to often change the administration sets at least every 6 hours, if not every 2 hours. So there are problems, and it's not in an inexpensive approach. Obviously, we still need IV access, which at this stage we may not have. Another approach to step three is the use of intravenous levetiracetam or Keppra. This is something which is rapidly becoming step two in many practices because of how effective it is. So we can give this drug as a bolus, and we give it often up to 60 milligrams per kilogram intravenously, but it can also be given intramuscularly if as yet you have not got IV access. It is obviously an anticonvulsant, but it's also anti-epileptic, meaning that it does protect the brain from further damage should there be protracted seizure activity. If the dog or cat is already on phenobarb, then they can be somewhat resistant to benzodiazepines, but they can also be a little bit resistant to levetiracetam, and so we need to look at giving the higher dose of this drug. We try to give it over about 10 minutes, but a more rapid administration is acceptable too. We give this and it usually lasts about 8 hours, after which time you can follow up with oral medication. So levetiracetam orally can be used, or you could follow up with long-term phenobarb. It's not necessary to follow up with the same drug. This can just be looked at as something getting them into a type of remission period for the seizure activity. So giving one bolus is maybe all you need in some cases. However, repeating it every 8 hours is another option as well. It takes just about 10 minutes to work, but it will keep on rising to peak activity up to about 40 minutes. So a very effective drug, a drug well worth considering having in your practice if you can get access to it. Its availability is not uniform, but it is a game changer if you can find where it can be purchased from. A recent study showed that giving intravenous levetiracetam in dogs was beneficial in these acute repetitive seizures, whereby comparing them to placebo and diazepam alone, where 10% responded, then up to 60% responded with the use of this drug combined with diazepam. And those in the placebo group required a lot more diazepam compared to levetiracetam. So this is at least a tested and evidence-based approach now to the treatment of seizure activity. As I said, its availability can be tough to get. What happens if benzodiazepines and phenobarb and or levetiracetam don't work? Well, at this stage now you have a refractory form of status epilepticus, and again someone needs to be talking to the owner about the fact that this is a serious matter, may not be possible to stop this seizure activity, and if we can stop it, it may lead to permanent damage of the brain and maybe more severe seizures in the future. However, to address the issue at hand, we need to try to induce a coma in this patient, similar to constant rate infusion of midazolam, but if that's not worked, then we can go with something which is more potent anesthetic, and that's propofol. The advantage of propofol is that in addition to being anesthetic, it is an anticonvulsant, so it can be used as a bolus. Unfortunately, it does need IV access, so whereas benzodiazepines in the form of midazolam Phenobarb and levetiracetam don't need IV access. Propofol obviously does, and so this is where we need to have something in place. Once the bolus has worked, that's what we choose to do. Then constant rate infusion can be used to follow it up, and much like the constant rate infusion of midazolam and midazolam and diazepam, then we can actually start to taper this off after 4 hours and look for its effect. Obviously an expensive issue, and the longer you use this, the more the risks that there are developing. Unlikely we're going to use it for 48 hours, but in people where this has been a treatment for status epilepticus, they can develop a propofol infusion syndrome, and this ends up resulting in metabolic acidosis, muscle damage, hyperpotassium and CK levels, and even renal failure and cardiovascular collapse. So quite a serious issue that comes about from extended propofol infusions. In cats, there's been a risk of oxidative damage to the red blood cells, resulting in Heinz body formation and hemolytic anemia. So a drug, again, that we need to use with caution. If propofol isn't something that you can use or isn't working, then another option that we have for refractory cases is ketamine. And this isn't something that we should be thinking about using immediately in our status epilepticus cases. This is reserved for those that have failed all other treatments and for cases where the seizure activity has been going on for over 30 minutes. So this has been used in status epilepticus in people for nearly 20 years, and has recently been used in dogs as well, to considerable effect. The reason that we use it after 30 minutes is that the seizure activity changes after that period of time to become more dependent on the brain damage that has been created by the extensive seizure activity. So the more seizures you have, the more release of endogenous neurotransmitter called glutamate occurs. And this glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter and a neurotoxin at the same time. Ketamine is an antagonist of glutamate. And so after 30 minutes, where glutamate becomes the main cause of seizure activity, we can use this drug to try to counteract its effects. It is metabolized by the liver in dogs, and so we need to be cautious in those dogs that are seizing because of underlying liver diseases, and often we'll use a benzodiazepine to try to prevent them from having the dysphoric emergence type reactions that they can have from this dissociative anesthetic. So it is a useful thing to consider if your seizure activity is not stopped for 30 minutes, in that we've tried benzodiazepines and one of the long-acting anticonvulsants as well. There's potentially a new drug coming on the market, although not advisable right now for the use in veterinary medicine because we haven't got enough data. This is a drug called lacosamide. It's currently being used as an intravenous anticonvulsant in people. It is something which doesn't affect other anticonvulsants being used, so it's quite an effective drug, and is eliminated through the kidneys without going through the liver, so a safe drug. In animal models, it's been very successful, but there's been no data at this stage in dogs, and in people, it is rapidly becoming a potentially step three drug for the treatment of status epilepticus, behind benzodiazepines and behind levetiracetam. Another drug which you might hear about and might make its way onto the veterinary market is fosphenytoin. Many of you will have heard about the use of phenytoin itself, but unfortunately when given intravenously to dogs it can be toxic, particularly to cardiac function. Fosphenytoin is a prodrug of phenytoin. After it's injected, phenytoin is cleaved by phosphatase enzymes. And the use of this drug then is based on the efficacy of phenytoin itself. The toxicity that is seen is related to phenytoin as well, but it's seen to be a much safer drug when given intravenously. A dose at this stage has been calculated is about 15 mg per kg, However, it has been used at lower doses and seen to be effective. About 80% of phosphenytoin is converted to phenytoin within 30 minutes, so it is something that potentially could be rapidly effective and maybe more safe than phenytoin itself. At this stage, not enough evidence to suggest that we should use it, so much like lacosamide, it is a drug for the future. So step seven is our last ditch set of attempts. Our last ditch set of attempts are those that, for the cases that we've tried, benzodiazepines, phenobarb, levetiracetam, if we have those available, that we've tried ketamine, potentially we've tried propofol. If those things haven't worked, then we're now looking at using things which we need to get the patient under a plane of anesthesia, for instance, to try and calm the situation down and then get a long-term anticonvulsant working in the background. Inhalational anesthesia is a potential. So if we can't stop the seizure activity, we can mask these patients down. We used to be told not to use this for seizure activity, and it's not ideal, but there is some new evidence to suggest that isoflurane might have some protective properties for the use in dogs with seizure activity. Dexmedetomidine, another drug which has been evaluated for status epilepticus in dogs, has been shown to recently been quite effective. Again, obviously an anesthetic agent, but again may have some protective properties for the brain. And lastly, potassium bromide, a very slow-acting drug, and so it's not really something we often equate with a drug for use in emergencies, but can be useful to load dose these patients onto onto it, so it's working in the background while other medications are keeping the dog under an anesthetic plane. So not ideal because it's going to take, if you load them with this dose, it's going to take 24 hours before it becomes effective. So it is something that is more of a background drug. While other drugs are trying to stop the aggressive activity up front. Step eight is now trying to address if you have stopped the seizure activity, the brain damage that may be present, and we haven't got a lot for this. Much like our head trauma talks, we're dealing with trying to reduce edema and subsequent intracranial pressure elevations. We don't use high doses of steroids because in a hypoxic environment they can be contraindicated. We may, over 2 or 3 days, use anti-inflammatory steroid doses to try to remove a little bit of the edema and decrease intracranial pressure. So 0.5 to 1 mg per kg per day of prednisone may be useful. However, we need the patient to be oxygenated to do this as well. So flow by oxygen is what we'll use. We won't use hyperventilation because, again, as in head trauma, hyperventilation, the use of excessive amounts of oxygen, can be damaging. Maybe that's all we need. However, some patients may benefit from fluid therapy in addition to the use of diuretics like furosemide. And once we know we're normotensive and we have been treated with fluids, than the use of a more potent osmotic such as mannitol. Step nine is post-seizure management. So if we have got these seizures under control and we haven't previously identified an underlying cause in this patient, we're unaware of it, then this is the time which we need to start focusing and talking to the owner about that. The only way, unfortunately, to do that would be with a test that we routinely use to document neurologic disease, and that would be with advanced imaging and with spinal fluid assessments. We may need to look at blood tests prior to this to again look at systemic health, thoracic abdominal imaging to look for underlying structural changes, evidence of inflammation, neoplasia, for instance, as a cause, urinalysis for the same reason, but also if we obtain it with an indwelling urinary catheter, we can identify renal function if this has been a protracted seizure event. We're worried about renal insufficiency, then we need to make sure that we have got normal production of urine. If we believe that the animal has had intoxication, then gastric lavage is a way forward to try to reduce the continued exposure of the patient to the toxin. However, it's not recommended if you have used multiple anticonvulsants and or patient is likely to go into seizure activity, because aspiration pneumonia is going to be a significant risk if we're doing this in our patients. We may face emergency seizure activity at home, and obviously the treatments we've described as being injectable are unlikely to be something we can give the owners to help at home. So we need to advise owners of several mechanisms that we could use to try to reduce cluster seizure activity or emergency seizure activity in the home front prior to getting veterinary attention. One of these is the use of a benzodiazepine, particularly diazepam, given rectally or even nasally. There are rectal diazepam suppositories available through pharmacies. These are often formulated for humans, but they're generic, so they can be used in dogs. Again, we try to use an eyeball dose of up to 2 mg per kg, which can be a lot of suppository in a large dog. The idea is that it'll take 10 minutes to work, so it won't stop the seizure activity immediately, but it might prevent roll-on activity. So in dogs that do cluster, so they exhibit one and likely to exhibit more, then it's something which may be useful at home. If the dog is already on phenobarb, as we've mentioned before, benzodiazepines can be less effective, so we need to use them at the higher dose. But something to consider. So at home, rectal diazepam, something to consider. Option two, if we don't go with this, is that in cases where the owner knows if the dog has one seizure is going to have 2, 3, 4, 8 seizures, then we could use top-up medications. So the use of a drug like clarazepate, although difficult to get in some countries, can be helpful. This is metabolized to nordiazepam, so essentially is a potent benzodiazepine and can be anticonvulsant on an oral basis, unlike diazepam. Unfortunately, only useful for up to 2 months, so this is for short-term breakthroughs. So if the owner says, well, my dog has multiple seizures every time it has one, then this would be the drug that we could use for 2 or 3 days at a dose of 0.5 mg per kg 2 to 3 times a day. It is very sedative, but it is something, again, that may stop the dog from having frequent seizure activity. And then option three is the use of pulsed levetiracetam. Because this is a rapid-acting drug, then the use of a pulsed levetiracetam, and where available, because again, not uniformly available, the use of extended-release levetiracetam as a one-off medication, pulsed dose of tablets, may be effective. As we can see here in the graph, the standard use, the immediate release of levetiracetam, can last for 8 hours, whereas the extended release can last for way over 8 hours, maybe more like 12 to 18 hours. So using pulsed oral levetiracetam can help. It's going to take a little while to get into the system, so it's only something we would do for cluster seizures as, again, a top-up, whether they were on this medication or not. Okay, so in summary, status epilepticus is an emergency that we should have some sort of plan for. It is something which can result in fatalities and morbidity, even if we're able to stop the seizure activity. Many times we're unaware as to the underlying cause, and so we should be communicating with the owners not only about the potential for fatalities, but also for the potential of an investigation being necessary once the seizure activity is stopped, if we can stop it. Cluster seizure treatment is a mix of a improved maintenance therapy as well as acute therapy. And the acute therapy options are the at-home options that we've discussed of rectal diazepam, addition of top-up doses of anticonvulsants such as levetiracetam, and the use of adjunct medications, short-acting, potent medications like clarazepate. So thanks very much for your attention. I hope that has helped a little bit in developing a treatment protocol for your emergency seizure activities. We have a couple of questions here. One of them is, should you consider using constant rate infusions of phenobarbital rather than pulse dosing? Well, based on the time it takes for phenobarbital to act and how long it lasts in the system, there's no real reason to use a constant rate infusion. We're only going to use that in our short-acting drugs. So constant rate infusion for benzodiazepines is a valid treatment option, although it's logistically challenging. But constant rate infusions of phenobarb is not going to be something which really are beneficial. We can just go with pulse doses every 4 to 6 hours. If we've got the dog under control, or every 30 minutes, if not, and to a maximum of 24 mg per kg over 24 hours. Another question is, should we dilute the levetiracetam if we give it injectably? Certainly, the data sheets suggest this, but if you're in a rush, then we have given undiluted levetiracetam to patients via IV catheter, and it has been safe over just several minutes rather than a protracted infusion. So we know that that is safe, and is something that can be effective. All right, well, if any other questions come through, I'll be happy to answer them. But in the meantime, thank you again for your attention, and hope that you've got something practical out of this talk.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.